You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
As history begins to see the long war in Syria through a bloody and clarifying lens, the precedents of this conflict show a preference for all-out slaughter over real military tactics, a preference for medieval sieges and targeting of civilians by killing doctors and attacking relief operations. Diplomats may talk about another ceasefire to replace the one that broke down last week. Meanwhile, another 26 died, many in hospitals, damaged in airstrikes over the weekend. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, has called the recent days chilling and the past week one of the worst ones in Syria during the nearly 6 years of this devastating conflict. That's his quote. Anne Bernard is Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. She joins me now. Anne, how have you been able to piece this story together?
It's always really hard to report on Syria these days because there's less and less access to what's happening on the ground physically. So as usual, we are in touch with many people that are living in East Aleppo, whether they're doctors or anti-government activists or random civilians, teachers, others, and also with international organizations, people in West Aleppo in the government-held side, and just as many people as we can who know about different aspects of the situation.
And how does the consensus begin to be that this is a strategy, that there's no caught in the crossfire randomness about this? This is a strategic.
Well, it's been 5.5 years of war, and it's been pretty clear long before the Russians became as deeply involved as they are, before they began their direct intervention with aerial attacks about a year ago. The Syrian government, which was always close to Russia and advised by it as well, has made it clear that if an area is controlled by opposition fighters, they will use a scorched earth tactic. We've seen that in the suburbs of Damascus. You can be standing in the middle of the capital and hear the outgoing artillery fire hitting its own suburbs. We've seen in the old city of Homs be completely destroyed, and eventually the people evacuated from there. Most of them still have not come back.
How would you describe the destruction in Aleppo as being of a different scale than what we've already seen? And what would you make of any effort by the government to completely retake Aleppo? What would that take?
It's not easy. There isn't a ground force on the Syrian government side that is capable of really taking and holding large areas on the ground. So either they're going to have to rely on some new injection of ground troops. There's been speculation about Russian ground troops, or they'll do what they've done in the past, which is bombard the place to smithereens and try to starve it and eventually try to make a deal where people surrender and come out. But again, in the past, it has taken years to do that. And this is a larger area with bigger stockpiles and more people and more territory than any other place where they've tried this strategy before.
I mean, are the Russians taking a page from their scorched earth policy in Afghanistan a generation ago?
Yes, and the more recent example is Grozny in Chechnya. When Putin had not been in power very long, one of the things that really brought him to prominence was his prosecution of the war in Chechnya, which is a semi-autonomous republic in Russia, which wanted to become fully independent. And basically, the strategy was to completely bomb it to the ground and then rebuild it and install a leader who's loyal to Moscow.
There's a grisly message from pro-government militia that you can see in certain places in Syria, and this would seem to describe it. What is that?
There have been graffiti written that say, starve or surrender. And that's after, in the past, another slogan was scrawled which said, Assad or we burn the country. But starve or surrender is essentially the tactic that's been used to try to empty rebellious areas, first with heavy bombardment and then with either allowing some people to come out and then continuing to bombard the people who stay, or eventually striking a deal under which people surrender by either going back to government areas or being bused to rebel-held areas. And both of those choices carry risk for people. But sometimes after years of deprivation and danger, they agree to take it.
Given what a fiasco this recent ceasefire was, is there any military countermeasure that the U.S. or the allies who claim to represent the anti-government or anti-ISIS forces can do to slow this down in Aleppo?
So proposals have floated around for years for various ways to ground the warplanes of the Syrian government, which are believed to be the biggest killer of civilians in the conflict. You could have a formal no-fly zone, or short of that, you could bomb runways and planes on the ground as a deterrent or as a preventive measure, or announce you will shoot down Syrian aircraft that bomb civilians, just sort of a no-bomb zone, and that might be all it takes. But there's no sign that the White House would consider those options. The shorthand understanding of this is that they don't want to get involved in another Middle East intervention after the disaster in Iraq, and the American public feels the same way. But the thing is, the U.S. is involved. They're backing some rebel groups and anti-ISIS groups. And at the same time, they're actively preventing their own allies from providing anti-aircraft weapons to the Syrian rebels that might be able to shoot down some of those planes. The Syrian opposition now says, we don't expect the U.S. to do anything to protect civilians, but then it shouldn't stop others from doing so. And most of all, it shouldn't legitimize the killers by engaging in fruitless negotiations with the same people, the Russians, who are backing Assad's air war.
Anne Bernard, Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Beirut. Thanks so much, Anne.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.